Hello, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Matt Duss. It's been a while since I did one of these. Last time I spoke, last time I did a Blogging Heads, I was at the Center for American Progress. As of this summer, I'm now with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. So hello again. I'm here with my longtime colleague, Rob Farley. He's a senior lecturer at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. Rob, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Weather's getting nicer. Let's not talk about the weather, but I just feel the obligation to throw that in there. How are things in Lexington?
Things in Lexington are lovely. The 14 inches of snow have now all melted, and so you can once again see the grass.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, very good. So, yeah, it's been an exciting few weeks on the Iran front. That's what we're going to talk about today. I think yesterday, all of Washington – well, Washington was abuzz about two things. One was the Hillary Clinton press conference, but early in the morning was the letter spearheaded by freshman Senator Tom Cotton. Basically, a letter signed by 47 members of the Republican Party, an open letter addressed to the leaders of Iran, explaining to them that even if they sign a deal, that it might not outlast this president. Now, I think here we are the day later, and you know, we've seen a number of stories indicating that Republicans, even some of whom who signed the letter, realized that it really was kind of a stupid stunt. But you know, given the people who supported this letter, namely Bill Kristol and other, you know, the neoconservatives have been gathering around Tom Cotton. He's sort of, as I see it, he's the new McCain in some ways. That's really what they specialize in, is stupid stunts rather than actual serious policy ideas. What do you think?
Well, I mean, first, I hardly think that we should, pose any sort of we should approach with any degree of skepticism the Republican Party's longstanding commitment to congressional oversight of foreign policy. And I think that the last 2 weeks have really demonstrated how clear and principled that commitment is. I mean, you know, it has long been a talking point of Republicans that foreign leaders should be able to come to the United States and come to the Congress and criticize the president. It has long been a principle of Republican foreign policy that Congress should take an overt role in undermining the foreign policy of the president in direct communications with the heads of foreign states. This is extremely consistent. I think that Dick Cheney wrote something about it at some point. And so this belief in congressional influence and effectiveness over foreign policy, and really, I mean, the idea that the executive of the United States is basically a figurehead who should have no real role in foreign policy, it goes back to Lincoln. It's been this way since Lincoln.
Deeply rooted in the conservative ethos, right?
Right. You know, it's been a fascinating few days. From the Netanyahu to the letter. You know, and I tweeted a little bit about this yesterday with respect to the Cotton letter. There was a sea of agitation towards this, and I was an island of tranquility because. there were a few things that were interesting about it. One, I have never been one who believes that politics end at the water's edge. I think that's really an absurd way to think about American foreign policy. Yeah. American politics, American governance has winners and losers, and foreign policy has winners and losers. And so Americans should be thinking about this sort of thing. The possibility of building cross-cutting transnational alliances is something that is just part of politics, and so doesn't really bother me. The second way is sort of a theoretical argument, and I think that a few people have mentioned this, that what the Cotton letter may in some sense do is not undermine Obama as much as empower him in respect to the actual negotiations that are going on right now. Yeah. Because in political science speak, in Putnam speak, it could narrow the win set of the United States, which could, if the Iranians are interested enough, force concessions on the Iranian side.
It could narrow. Say that again.
So the theory here is that it's called the theory of two-level games. And the theory is that each player in a negotiation has what's called a win set, a range of possible outcomes that they can abide by. And the idea is to narrow your win set as much as possible.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've heard. So basically, you're making the same argument here. Mm-hmm. You know, Congress all along, you know, pushing new sanctions and making clear they were hostile to the deal, et cetera, actually acts as a kind of tool in Obama's favor.
It could also move the win set completely away, right? It could scotch the deal or it could produce a better deal.
Well, see, I'm skeptical of arguments like that because, I mean, this is something that Iran hawks have made all along, that we're just trying to strengthen Obama's hand. And, you know, if there's one thing Iranians understand is that the American Congress is hostile to Iran.
Right.
I don't think there's any doubt in the minds of Iranians, certainly the Iranians who are negotiating with the U.S., who are, I think has been shown, you know, including, you know, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, who quite clearly understands, you know, the mechanics of American governance better than Tom Cotton does, how hostile, you know, how small a window Obama actually has and what a challenge it will be for him to get congressional support for this. So I think it's the impact has almost been entirely negative to say to the Iranians, listen, even if you sign this deal, it's possible that the U.S. government will not honor. So I think that's, you know, and Cotton himself has been quite clear that his goal is precisely
negotiations. I think that any effect in terms of producing a better deal is wholly incidental to the actual purposes of the hawks, right? The purpose of the hawks is clearly to kill the deal. But, you know, there is this potential that it could produce, you know, nevertheless, despite their best efforts, could produce a better deal. But, you know, this is not surprising coming from this group of people, right? I mean, this is sort of... You know, that's anything happened that happens that's good is clearly incidental and clearly, you know, not intended. So, so, but, you know, it was interesting again, and this is sort of the IR guy thinking is that, you know, we think about deals or negotiations a lot. And one of the big things is here is credible commitments. And so, you know, I haven't seen exactly who drafted this letter, but it is kind of interesting to me that it was very much talking in an IR. In an IR speak here, you know, the things that kill deals are often the inability to produce credible commitments, right? And so that's kind of what's happening. That's kind of the argument that's happening here. So it was interesting. It was interesting. Right.
Well, I think there's that. I mean, there's the substantive, you know, you can look at what the kind of stated goals were. But then there's also the angle, and I think Brian Beutler wrote a really interesting piece on this yesterday, saying, you know, there's also the aspect here of Tom Cotton just kind of setting himself up as the new leader, and there's, you know, and of course, that's the play, and that's always the play when you know the neocons are involved. There's always a domestic political angle to it.
Right.
But I think, you know, looking at it, and getting back to the Beutler piece, he raised a point, and this is something I've been thinking about for a while because I wrote a piece for Tablet a couple weeks ago, right before the Netanyahu speech. You know, kind of responding to some of the claims that, you know, the whole controversy was Obama's fault, blah, blah, blah. And I just raised the comparison. It's like if Democrats had invited French President Jacques Chirac to come to Congress and oppose the Iraq invasions, I don't even have to describe what Republicans would have said. They would have had a series of alien babies across the floor of Congress, just in screaming treason from the rooftops.
Right.
Cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria.
Right.
But say, you know, staying on this, what if he had? Would a violation, sure, it would have been a violation of norms, just as the Netanyahu speech and the Cotton letter are a violation of norms. But would it have been worth it to sort of upend the table like that if there was a chance the U.S. would not have made a huge mistake and invaded Iraq? And, you know, I think you have to say, it would have been worth it for Democrats to kind of go outside the bounds of what was, you know, previously seen as acceptable. So, and again, I realize I'm in this kind of thought experiment, I'm actually, you know, attributing more good faith to Republican opposition on the Iran deal than I think they actually deserve, because they've been quite clear since the beginning of Obama's administration that their main goal was to see that his presidency was a failed one.
Right.
But still, you know, in looking at the Iran policy, I think it offers just the opposite example, and I think a much better example of how to use American power than Iraq did in a whole range of ways: diplomacy over war, advancing American security through multilateral organizations, and the cultivation of international consensus. But I think we should extend that and say, listen, one of the problems with the Iraq war is that the Bush administration shoved it down America's throat. They spun the intelligence. They strong-armed senators. They made all kinds of wild claims, again, you know, personal attacks, claims about the threat Iraq posed. And so I think, listen, let's if Iran is going to be the anti-Iraq for the U.S., let's extend that. Let's actually try and have a much more robust and rigorous debate about exactly why this is the right policy.
I mean, if I can boil down what you said, are you suggesting that the norms of congressional deference to the executive in terms of foreign policy are overstated and potentially harmful? And that,
yes.
You know, that the sort of the disposal of them in this situation is, you know, however we may feel about the particular situation and the people who are doing it, but it's an act of good. I mean, really, in the end, I mean, to bring Congress back into foreign policy is an act of
positive. Totally agree. And I think, especially for the previous few years, I think it's less now. But, you know, going back a couple of years, I mean, there's no question the Obama administration was consulting and communicating and engaging with Congress very, very closely. Maybe not as closely. I mean, Congress always wants more opportunities to take pot shots at the administration. But, you know, based on what I've heard, and I think others who've covered this issue would agree, you know, the administration, especially at key moments of decision making, has really made themselves available to the Hill on this stuff. But over the past year, especially when things got really heated over the interim deal, and you had people like Mark Kirk and others really just being more and more explicit that their main goal was to use any possible opportunity to seize upon any possible misstatement or kind of questionable answer by any member of the administration just to scuttle and stall and put blocks up in front of this policy. You know, I think we can understand why the administration might not be super psyched to send people over to the Hill constantly to give them those opportunities.
Right. Well, and I mean, there's sort of a broader, and, you know, this comes into, you know, what might be a rejoinder to what we're talking about right now, which is that, you know, even in the best of times, the Hill is a bit dysfunctional. These are not the best of times. You know, to the extent that people on the Hill are interested in foreign policy, they are. It's exactly as you phrased it. They are often interested in taking pot shots rather than in serious long-term engagement in the foreign policy decision-making, right? And so I think that frustration from executives, and this I think is both Bush and Obama and previous executives, has been, you know, sort of very much that even when you try to make Congress a partner, it's an unproductive partner, right? It changes and the people there, you can't really keep their attention and they don't know very much about it. But they're very critical at times. And so, it's tough to have a productive dialogue. I mean, it's easy to have a productive dialogue with specific congressional personnel. And I would sort of be interested in hearing if you read the, was it New York Magazine? The Pfeiffer article about sort of how the Obama administration eventually became, the Obama team became disillusioned with the idea of even negotiating with Republicans over the course of 4 or 5 years. But I can see the frustration.
Yeah, I don't think I've read that one.
Well, yeah. So the argument he made was that, look, you know, we tried, and even people in the GOP tried, but it didn't matter if they tried or not, because everybody there who actually, you know, had a position was worried about being primaried and worried that any conversation they had with Obama was going to result in them being primaried. And so even if the people we were talking to were interested in a deal, interested in constructive collaboration, it was pointless. And so we eventually decided it was just useless.
Exactly. And you get to the same Putnam, the limited window of anyone to deliver. So what's the point? You know, which reminds me, I think it was, who was it? Someone wrote a funny article yesterday about how Iran had offered to mediate between the Congress.
And Borowitz. I think it was Andy Borowitz who wrote that. Yeah. Borowitz report.
So anyway, the deal, what more to say about the letter? I think, you know, today even you have signs of the letter, McCain and others saying maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. And of course they're blaming Obama for this, but you know, at the very least, I think it's a very strong signal that this whole thing backfired, and at least in terms of its substantive aims. But again, going to the kind of secondary aims, or maybe even the primary aims, were to kind of to raise a flag for Tom Cotton as this new voice of the neoconservatives in Congress, which, you know, just to stay on that for a minute, I mean, it is really interesting, you know, the comparisons to McCain here. He's got a great biography. Mm-hmm. He's very aggressive. He clearly thinks he knows more than he actually does, and he's willing to tell everybody who will listen about it. I mean, that comment he made yesterday about there's nothing in Iran but hardliners. I mean, it's nice when the mask drops about, the support and that we're supposed to show toward Iranian human rights activists or pro-democracy Iranians.
Right.
Make up your minds. Either we're selling out those pro-human rights activists in Iran, or they don't exist, you know?
Right. It sort of struck me, and especially sort of the backtracking a little bit, it kind of struck me as one of these sort of a litmus test that is a sort of a blow and in the ongoing conflict within the Republican Party on foreign policy. But the ongoing conflict, which, you know, I guess we could characterize it in a bunch of different ways, has always sort of seemed to me that the neocons have a pretty substantial advantage on, even, the whatever you want to call the realists or whomever, did make some inroads in the past few years. But this is sort of an indication that here is the sort of thing that you do if you're the Republican senator. And here's the sort of paper you put in front of your senator if you're a foreign policy advisor.
Right.
And I'd say, this is a good thing to sign right now because everybody else is signing and everybody's talking about how we need to be signing this right now. And so it was interesting in terms of how strongly they were able to push through it. Now, who did not sign it among the Republicans? Do you know? Do you remember? Did Paul sign it?
No, Rand Paul signed it.
Oh, he did sign it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Rand.
Corker didn't sign, which is notable given that he's one of the main sponsors of this bill, mm-hmm. pushing for congressional oversight of any deal. I'm banking on some of the others, but I think Corker was probably the most significant, given that his bill is the key one that a lot of and Graham actually claimed that it was Obama's threat to veto the Corker bill that kind of pushed him over the edge. That caused him to sign the Cotton letter.
Mm-hmm. That's what pushed you over the edge, huh, Lindsey?
Yes, exactly. That's what turned Lindsey Graham into a crazy hawk. But, I think you've seen – this is just only the latest example of overreach on this. I think after the Netanyahu speech, Mitch McConnell attempted to fast-track the Corker-Menendez bill and was opposed by Menendez, one of the co-sponsors of that bill, who was like, easy, easy. Let's not move too quickly on this. So, just getting back to the Netanyahu speech as, the previous stunt, it seems to me – maybe I'm wrong, and I'm curious what you think. It seems to me that was pretty much a total failure. I think the speech may have had some positive impact for Netanyahu himself amongst his own base back in Israel, for whom just Netanyahu as this defiant spokesman on the world stage has a lot of value. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to see how, especially with the new Gallup poll that showed, that his popularity in the U.S. declined after that speech. It's hard just for me to see, what value the speech actually had for the Hawks case.
Right. No, it's not clear that it moved the needle, and it's not clear that it would even matter if it moved the needle on public opinion. Right. I mean, so at this point, what other than a change of heart in the Obama administration could stop a deal if they could come to some sort of negotiated agreement with Iran, right? I mean, it's clear Iran could stop a deal by not complying in the end with some sort of agreement that the United States. And I do want to talk a little bit about the substance moving forward. But so it's clear that Iran could stop a deal. It's not clear to me what could stop a deal in the United States at this point, right? Even if you move public opinion against it. I mean, we have sort of reached this lame duck, Obama just doesn't give a damn anymore, right? I suppose you could make the argument that it would move, that a significant move on the needle of public opinion would change Democratic congressional, which might have some sort of effect, would have some sort of effect with the Corker Menendez and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that the primary result of this was to make BB less popular with significant parts of the United States, continue to drive a wedge into the American Jewish community, a wedge which BB's side is not winning, right? And you know, just from what I've read from in the Israeli press recently, it doesn't even, it may have helped him with his base in Israel, but it doesn't necessarily seem to have helped him overall, right? That he
right.
He does appear a bit of a buffoon, at least to some eyes,
right.
carrying on.
No,
like
and it seemed, yeah, and it does seem like the momentum just in the past few days has mm-hmm. shifted against Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's really interesting, I mean, we've had this kind of, there's been this kind of assumption from a lot of people that, you know, when an Israeli prime minister fights with an American president, it's bad
mm-hmm.
for the Israeli right. prime minister. But I think Netanyahu has shown that that's only true if Americans like, or Israelis like the American president.
Right.
And
right.
Israelis, you know, do not really like or trust Barack Obama.
Right.
And so Netanyahu has been able to reap some real political benefits by continued by this tension. But I think what does, I mean, and we are seeing now what is having it is when it's not a personal thing, when the Israeli prime minister is not just seen as fighting with an American president, but an Israeli prime minister is seen as being a bad steward of the special U.S.-Israel relationship, which is obviously the most important strategic relationship Israel has. And we've seen a steady drip, and I think it's increased in its volume over the past few weeks, of Israeli security, you know, former Israeli security officials, very
right.
credible voices on security issues saying what Netanyahu is doing here is bad for Israel's security. And I think that we will probably see has
right.
some effect.
I mean, and you know more about Israeli politics than I do, but I mean, the percentage that sort of holds to this kind of, you know, the Carolyn Glick view that Israel can sort of just shift its, Israel can replace the United States' special relationship, doesn't appear to be a particularly popular idea in Israel for a whole, one, because it's insane, and two, because there are you know, substantial long-term
right.
cultural connections between Israel and the United States, right? And that,
right.
you know, leveraging those is clearly sort of Israel's best bet.
Right.
You know, but and I think what, you know, what other people have brought up with respect to the United States is that, you know, how could you ever approach this relationship and think that turning Israel into a partisan issue in the United States is good for Israel, right? I mean, it's just staggering that someone could seem to believe that, right? That
mm-hmm.
You know, that supporting one of the American parties against the other one is a mm-hmm. positive step, is good for Israel on the U.S. stage. And yet, mm-hmm. like Netanyahu and Dermer and some of the Republicans seem to I mean, it's great for the Republicans, right? But they seem to think this is a good idea, right? And it's crazy to me. It's madness.
Yeah, right. No, I think it is too. But I mean, for them, you know,
right.
for
right.
Republicans, frankly, from my point of view, I think you know the irony of all this is that you know Netanyahu, Dermer, and their allies here in the U.S. have really prized open this debate on U.S.-Israel policy
mm-hmm.
that is long overdue and which I welcome. Because, you know, given some of the things that are happening in Israeli society right now, given the level of open racism and bigotry against you know, Palestinian Israelis, some of the crazy statements we saw from Israeli leaders during the Gaza war, et cetera, you know, I think there are really legitimate questions that American progressives and Democrats need to be asking about the nature of the U.S.-Israel relationship. Not certainly not that, you know, we're going to just abandon Israel or end the relationship. Not
mm-hmm.
at all. It's just like, okay, when we talk about shared values, what are those values?
Mm-hmm.
Let's identify those in Israel and those in the U.S. who do share values, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's been one of the very, very interesting consequences of all of this, is just opening this discussion, which I think many here in Washington have tried to, you know, keep quiet or suppress for a long time. But still, I mean, you look at, you know, groups and, you know, we come back to Crystal and groups like the Emergency Committee for Israel. It seems that what they're doing, it has nothing primarily to do about foreign policy. It's just kind of elevating this as a key conservative Republican issue.
Right.
For very short-term political benefit, kind of grabbing Israel and, you know, as part of this broader argument about the West versus Islam.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because, yeah, I mean, we get back to this idea that, you know, neoconservative foreign policy is a component of domestic policy. You know, they promote these ideas because it's good for, you know, for creating a conducive political environment for conservative victories.
Right. So, to skip past the politics for a second,
mm-hmm.
What is your sense right now of the state of the deal in Geneva? I mean, what's going on between Kerry and the United States and Iran right now? So what are we going to see in the next couple, next, I guess it's 3 weeks that we have, in the next 3 weeks with respect to the negotiations and the deal?
I mean, well, we keep hearing reports that, you know, they're closing the gaps, they're closing the gaps. I mean, I think the main sticking points, continue to be, you know, number of centrifuges. I think the 6,500 number is one that was most recently thrown out, even though Iran insists they want 10,000 or more. And then there's the duration of the inspections regime, like a special inspections regime. 10 to 15 years is what the administration is now talking about, although that's not, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But I think a point that needs to be made that is often forgotten. I mean, and the new argument that you hear against the deal is that, okay, after 10 years, Iran is allowed to get a nuclear weapon. But of course, that's stupid. You know, after the duration of the special inspections regime, 10 or 15 years, Iran will go back to a normal status as a member of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means inspectors will continue to have access to its nuclear programs on a regular basis. It won't have the intensive inspections. So, you know, again, if Iran decided to get a nuclear weapon at some point after that, it would be somewhat easier for them to do that. But it kind of gets to the point that Iran already has the capability of obtaining a nuclear weapon now.
Right.
It's just been made clear to them, I think quite effectively by Obama and the U.S.'s partners, that that's not in their interest. Right. That if they do that, that will not work out well for them. And that's something that will continue to be made clear even after this heavy inspection regime ends. So I think those are two of the main issues. I mean, there's another issue you should mention here is that's ongoing with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is Iran sort of coming clean and explaining the nature of their previous work that many believe intelligence agencies believe what, you know, the CIA and others, what had a definite weapons military application.
Right. So I'm going to interrupt you here for a second because I happen to, and maybe you saw this, it was passed around, but I have a prop here. It is a, advertisement by the nuclear power industry in the United States that used the Shah of Iran to basically try to sell nuclear power plants in the United States. And I'm going to put it up here. The Shah of Iran is sitting on top of one of the largest reservoirs of oil in the world. Yet he's building two nuclear power plants and planning two more to provide electricity for his country.
Right.
He knows the oil is running out and time with it. But he, the Shah of Iran, wouldn't build the plants if he doubted their safety. He'd wait.
That's right.
As many Americans want to do.
That's right.
And it's just sort of a fantastic sort of, you know, you would bring in the Shah of Iran to try to convince voters in the United States and, you know, Iranian nuclear powers. It's great. We've been passing it around in the department over the past few days, and it's been fantastic. It's very interesting.
Good times. Good times.
So, some of the stuff that I've seen written in some of the magazines that I write for, which are often have a more Asia focus, have been talking about China's role in this larger relationship, and have sort of been, you know, pointing out that, so say negotiations fail, say that, you know, the Cotton Netanyahu coalition prevents a deal from being made, that the Iranians get cold feet. What is the aftermath of that, right? The aftermath is not going to be an Israeli strike. The aftermath is not going to be American B-2s over Iran. But what is the aftermath going to look like?
I think the aftermath, and this is, again, one of the upshots, I think, of the Cotton letter, is that they've managed, you know, they've kind of taken ownership. The Republican Party of the United States has taken ownership of the collapse of the Iran talks if and when they happen. Because now the Iranians can very conceivably say, well, you know, we don't like this deal. It's not good enough. And plus, the Republican Party, the party in power in Congress, just told us that we couldn't trust any deal. So we're walking away. Whether that's true or not, it has now become much, much more plausible as an excuse. So I think, yeah, if the deal collapses, you know, we'll probably see China, you know, backing away from its support for sanctions, which I think has been a real success of this policy. And the Europeans themselves, even though it would probably be slower at that, I think one thing you really need to understand is that Americans haven't been doing business for real with Iran for over 30 years since the revolution. So, you know, the idea, these sanctions don't really bite in the United States. Okay. American businesses are not paying as much of a price. They're not feeling the cost of this sanctions policy. Europeans, however, European businesses, European corporations have really felt it. You know, and they are the ones who are pressuring, who can be expected to really pressure their governments in the wake of talks collapse to say, listen, okay, you guys tried. Mm-hmm. We have a market there. We're ready to do business. We were doing business there before. And so I think that's something that we'd see sort of in the medium term is Europeans right. saying, okay, we gave it a shot.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that would be the impact. The whole sanctions regime would simply crumble away.
Right. And, you know, I think it has been, you know, especially in context of what's been going on in Ukraine, it has been a masterful job of keeping the Russians on board on this. And they're not going to stay on board after the talks collapse. Right. I mean, this is a one-time thing with respect to Russia. And you know, and their interest, Russia and China interest is pretty much the same, right? That, you know, on balance, they would prefer not to have the instability associated with an Iranian nuclear program. But, you know, in the end, if it's going to happen, then, you know, they're not going to take the lead in terms of paying costs. So,
right.
Do you think that if a deal does happen, or if it doesn't happen, actually, that it will have any kind of effect on sort of ongoing cooperation between Iran and the United States in the struggle against ISIS, in the conflict against ISIS?
I think it could. I think it's possible to overstate that. But I mean, listen, the case that the administration's made is one I think is plausible. I mean, if we look at, you know, what was done in Afghanistan, how the U.S. and Iran were cooperating in post-invasion Afghanistan, post-Taliban Afghanistan, there was a real opening there for cooperation. And who knows where that would have led had the Bush administration not chosen to include Iran in the axis of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by most accounts, I think, including Ryan Crocker, who's written about this, the former ambassador, really scuttled any possibility of U.S. and Iranian continued cooperation. I think if we can achieve some measure of trust on the nuclear issue and kind of close that file, you know, I think that does create the opportunity for the U.S. and Iran to talk more seriously about, okay, what other interests do we have in common? Not like we're going to become best friends, not like it's going to be a complete opening, but... You know, and it's very possible, given the people who are in charge in Iran, especially the supreme leader who is known to just be very paranoid about the United States, not without reason, mm-hmm. but also very, you know, from what I've read, he's very aware and very familiar with the story of Eastern Europe, the Velvet Revolution, the way that increased engagement between the Soviet Union and Soviet bloc countries and the United States and the West slowly led to, you know, slowly inexorably led to the collapse or contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Empire. So he's very aware of using engagement and, you know, across a range of issues, whether it's artistic, intellectual, you know, right. all these different kinds of exchanges and the impact that these could have. And of course, for people like me and others who want to see a democratic Iran, who want to see a more, you know, who want to see Iran change. I mean, that's one of my goals. I understand why the U.S. government can't proclaim that goal. I think that's smart. But yeah, just to answer your question in a less long-winded way, is to say, I think there's a possibility that if we close the nuclear file, it does it, you know, and we've done so in a way that shows that we can deal with each other in you know, in a manner that's respectful and creates trust, that we could potentially move to some other issue.
All right. Well, that's all the time I have for today. But I think this has been a great conversation, and we should have this more often. We should have these conversations.
Yes. All right.
All right. Well, thank you for entertaining with viewers, and we will see you again soon.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye, Rob.